Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, sir. Everybody, welcome to Bottom Up Radio Network. Welcome, bitch. Was Elliot Brood of President 35. Thank you, Elliot, for letting us steal your music to use on our show. Welcome to the show, everybody. Can we hear a scream so we can convince people that people come to hear us sometimes? In a live capacity.
All three of them.
All three of them.
All right. So, it's our first week back on a regular kind of schedule. Last week was... was a pretty insane show. G20 was gone, basking it up in a hot tub.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. It's kind of a shitty hot tub, though. It was really disappointing.
Yeah?
Yeah. And,
is there such thing as a shitty hot tub?
Only if you shit in it.
Oh.
Hey-o. Poo.
Poo. But last week was a pretty important week. It was the end of a really crazy week here at Muddy Waters. Ella, what was the end result of last week's insanity? What was the end result of last week's insanity?
$6,000 in 6 days.
$1,000 a day.
Nice. So it looks like Muddy Waters is going to be kicking in the waters for a bit longer while it gives us some time to stay afloat until we reorganize, right? Wonderful. Everybody, give it up for everybody that works really hard to do that. So we're having, of course, some technical difficulties with the switchboard and whatnot on the computer, but what would a burn show be if it actually worked correctly? What the fuck, man? Tonight we decided to go without a guest.
We're going with the flow. We're guestless. It's just us and
right.
Our good looks and personalities. So
for the first few months of doing this show, Travis and I didn't always have a guest, and we would get to spend a lot of time bullshitting on this show about things that were important to us, and now that we're in a live community setting, this is the first time we've done a burn episode without a guest since we started doing it live.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to see how this works, see if this works with the audience, see if people here want to contribute, and see if we can keep it going for 2 hours, keep it interesting.
Two full hours of just us.
Yeah, it already sounds pretty painful. That's
yeah, I mean, the show's been going 5 minutes, and I'm already, I'm exhausted. So I saw Avatar this week, and it's totally racist, and Dances with Wolves, but awesome.
Dances with Aliens?
Dances with Aliens. But the most interesting part about Avatar is that it's, have you guys heard of Avatards? Anybody heard of Avatards? Avatards are people who, after seeing Avatar, get depressed. And have to keep returning to the movie so they can go live in that world of Pandora.
So it's kind of like gamers.
It's kind of like gamers. And see, and I thought this was really interesting because I'm really open about this. I am an MMO gamer. I played the World of Warcraft. MMO? An MMO is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game. And I play them. I played like 7 or 8 of them. And so I got to thinking today, why are people so obsessed with these virtual environments, including this movie? You know, because, I mean, I've seen the movie in 3D, and it's really amazing. It's very immersive and very beautiful and everything. I didn't get depressed afterwards, but...
Well, here's the thing about that. I haven't seen the movie yet because I don't have, like, $35 to go see the fucking movie. Not that I don't want to, because I do, and... This is interesting. This is the first Hollywood film in a long time that's been receiving a lot of press in the anarchist and primitivist and anti-civilization world, really touting this film as being a break-in film in Hollywood to introduce these ideas. I haven't seen it yet, but I've got to say I don't buy it to start off with. Like, I just don't buy a $250 million movie because it makes people think, wow, primitivism, yeah, that's the way to go. CGI really made me into a primitivist. Doesn't really make that much sense to me. But beyond that, there's been a shitload of movies that have really been great to showcase these ideas of an anti-civilization theory that have come out other than Avatar. So I don't know why this one's big. I guess it's because it's James Cameron. Because it is so big and it is like in the mainstream, it is on the tips of everybody's tongue. It's kind of strange to hear people at the water cooler at work, if you have a water cooler at work, or if you work, or if you care. If you talk to your coworkers,
yeah, I don't.
I'm a list maker personally. Yeah, when I'm at work, I just sit back and make lists all day.
See, I think it's because virtual worlds and a movie like Avatar, which is just a particularly immersive movie. I think when people experience a virtual environment like this, I think it's something a lot more abstract. Because at first I thought, okay, well maybe people are really into this because it wakes up that primal, man, I want to get back to this, like, beautiful nature thing. At first, I thought it was kind of maybe that, like some deep-seated spiritual subconscious reconnection with nature. But
we also refer to as liberal guilt.
Right, white guilt, particularly. By the way, I don't have any white guilt. I'm totally free of white guilt. It's awesome.
Such a lie.
By the way, no white guilt
here. He totally donates online. He has a child.
Oh, I do. Her name's Myrna in Honduras. But that's not...
Yeah, look, that's not at all due to his white guilt.
My money sees no color. So anyway, I think it's because in a virtual environment, people have a taste of escaping from this environment, and the environment that we're in is one that's not free. And I think that people have a little taste of freedom in these kind of escapist environments. And I think the reason that they're getting depressed and the reason that people develop these huge dependencies in these virtual environments, like video gaming. By the way, I don't have dependence on video games. For the record,
I developed one this weekend.
Nice. To what?
Rock Band.
Ooh, nice. Yeah. That's an
Yeah, my brother-in-law has Rock Band, and we both have children, but none of the children got to play Rock Band at all.
Nah. Not for kids.
No, video games will rot your brain.
Video games are not for kids.
Go play. Good.
So I think it's a feeling an environment of less consequence, being a little less constricted, and I think that when people have a taste for something like that, whether it's in a computerized environment or in a movie environment, I think there's just a desire in us to be free. Like recently, there was a study that just was published that I'll look it up. I don't keep track of any of my sources, so I totally could be making this up. So you just have to believe me or not. But there was a research done recently that showed that people behave better when they're free, when they're left to decide their own destiny, when they're free to do as they please.
No.
That is scientific data has shown that when people are free to do what they want, they function better.
We all know Picasso painted in lines. It was all paint by numbers. It was such a bullshit.
You know, in fourth grade, it was Thanksgiving, fourth grade, and we had to color turkeys. And I've never been a colorer, okay? And it was one of those ones where you colored it and then you cut it out, you know what I mean? And then you hung it up on the wall and everybody made a big deal out of it. Well, see, I was like, okay, well, fuck it. You know, if I'm going to cut it out, I might as well just color all over the whole thing. Why color in the lines? I'm just going to cut the fucking thing out, right? And so we do that, and the teacher comes over and he goes, oh, this is not how we color in this, guys. Holds up my shitty turkey coloring thing to show 30 little demon children who all started to laugh at me. I totally started crying. Like, public education sucks. So what was my point? I do this a lot, by the way. I never have any idea where I'm going with it.
I get a contact high just from sitting next to you.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's the pot.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I want to talk about, I was thinking about this today. I got up really early this morning, and I stayed the night at my brother's house last night, so he has a TV, so I was like, I'm going to take advantage of this TV thing. And apparently on HDTV, which is what they have, or direct or whatever it is, where you could, like, tell the TV what you want to watch instead of the other way around, which is, you know, control. You control your life when you control the TV. I learned this morning. Apparently they have an entire section of programs that are dedicated to Martin Luther King for this week. And you can click on this button that says Martin Luther King Jr., and you can choose from a list of programs. And there was a few different programs that looked somewhat interesting. One of them was, which of course grabbed me immediately, was Conspiracy MLK. And so I clicked on this, and I spent the morning watching this conspiracy theory be debunked and rebunked. Can you rebunk something? It was debunked and rebunked repeatedly by experts in their field. And one of the things that I found was really interesting is any of the people that were in Martin Luther King Jr.'s circle of close friends that spoke about how they had a deep-seated feeling that this was a carried out by a government entity of some sort, they were instantly paradoxed by an expert who was some 22-year-old kid from a college. 98% of them were white or so. And they were saying, well, this is physically impossible. We've proven that James Earl Ray can make this shot and blah, blah, blah. And I got to thinking how much, number one, I don't care anymore. You know, it's 40 years ago. I don't care who killed him. Like, the state should pay anyway, I think. Because if he weren't killed, it still would have been a life led under the rule and the watchful eye of the FBI. But no, the other thing I was thinking is how much we turn to these things to receive expert opinion. And it goes even further when we start watching fictional films. I remember when District 9 came out, people were like, oh, do you think District 9 is racist or anti-racist? And I'm like, I think it's a fucking movie. And I think you attach to it any bullshit ideas that you want to attach to it. You can look at it in any which way you want. But people really look to these films as a direction for their life. And I'm not saying that's necessarily bad, because I watched A River Runs Through It probably 35 times so I could learn how to fly fish. I didn't have a dad that fished, and I was like, well, this is a fly fishing movie, and it's a really good movie based on a really good book. It's got fucking Brad Pitt, so I watched it a lot. It's good. If you haven't seen it, it's really good. And I didn't learn how to fly fish, but I did learn not to watch movies to learn something. And I don't think we can learn anything from watching these films, personally. So I think we should treat them as entertainment, because that's what they are, and we should be entertained by them. I think it should be a break from this everyday thing we call life that's teaching us these horrible lessons all the time. Not that you can't sneak premises into films. I think Mel Gibson does that shit all the time, right? He sneaks his premises in. And that leads me to the next train of thought that came from this train of thought. See, this is how the trains go. They split and divide.
Like a remote control.
Right. The next train of thought was about Mad Max and how Mad Max is awesome, right? When you're 5, 6, 9, 10, like, you fucking love Mad Max. You love all three Mad Max movies.
Road Warrior is the only good one.
Bullshit. Thunderdome was awesome. It had Tina Turner and a mongoloid, and it was awesome.
And it had the little midget.
But these movies are looked to as being like, well, without civilization, once civilization falls, we're going to be facing an atmosphere much like that of Mad Max. We're going to be facing feudalism, and people are going to be... No. See, I think that things like that and The Road, these post-apocalyptic films, they shouldn't be viewed as anti-civilization propaganda. They should be shown as end result of civilization propaganda, because these films are the end result. Like these ideas, these post-apocalyptic worlds where we're slitting each other's throats over clean water, Tank Girl, all that crap, good films, right? They're fun to watch. But that's not anti-civilization. That's what civilization comes to. That's where it takes us to, because it's hanging on to the ideas of civilization, and it is the end result. When you completely rape, pillage, and destroy and steal from something until it's gone, then you're going to be fighting over the scraps of it. So I think maybe we need to not be viewing these as anti-civilization or primitivist films.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're none of those things. I mean, if anything, they advance the idea that without civilization or the institutions of civilization, this is how the world will become without all of these institutions to protect us and feed us and clothe us. Without those institutions, we'll break down into Mad Maxian communities. And I just think that's a false conclusion based on our fear of letting these things go, because the institutions of civilization are built fundamentally on violence, which is very closely related to fear. And if we grow dependent on these institutions around us, the idea of them being gone, it's kind of like quitting smoking. Is that it's really scary, and we don't want to let them go. And if you have enough images in your head that if we don't have these institutions, then we're not going to have the necessary things we need to survive. Therefore, you're going to end up with Waterworld. You're going to end up, by the way, Waterworld sucks, but you're going to end up with Waterworld. Yeah, right? Lame. You're going to end up with these environments of
Inca. Did you really? You like Waterworld?
Yeah, it's
on
fun.
Purpose?
Yeah. shit.
No, yeah, but I got to disagree with one statement that you made, where you said that this culture is based on violence, that civilization is based on violence. I would say yes to a degree, but I think more so it's based upon the hiding and controlling and limiting of violence. It's based upon taking away experience firsthand and offering up an idea of experience, violence being a part of that, but it's controlled violence, and it's very directed violence. And when I say that, I'm talking about the everyday violence of living, of eating or consuming, is hidden from us. We don't see the violent beginnings to the consumerist ends. We don't have that connection. So the violence is very much removed, especially when you live in a first world nation. The violence of all of the products, all the plastic that you have, all of the food that you're getting shipped from Chile, all of these things, that violence that is required to bring you those things is removed. So it's not based on violence. It's actually based on pacifism. It's based on this passive idea of accepting what comes and not understanding the violence required to obtain those things. If we knew that experience firsthand, chances are we'd fight against it. And perhaps that's where Avatar comes in. The people that could fight against effectively the machine in that film were the ones who were soldiers, who knew firsthand what the violence was and knew firsthand what was going to be happening. Those, of course, the oppressed is the first one who has the option to fight back. But I think that if we take cues from films like that and those ideas, we see things every day. We see soldiers that are refusing to go back into war because they understand what that violence is. They understand where our oil comes from, where our plastic comes from, where our food comes from. And so they're not removed, and that's how they lose their minds. And we see this. Suicides now amongst soldiers are four times the amount of civilians. It's the highest suicide rate for soldiers in history. We see that they're losing their minds and losing their grasp on life because they are subjected firsthand to the violence that we get five or six steps removed.
And I'm not talking about, you know, like violence in general. I mean, we're primates, we're monkeys, and we have violent tendencies. So I'm not just talking about the kind of in general type of violence. I'm specifically talking about the initiation of force as a viable means to one's ends. And I think that one of our first acts of violence in that context was to begin keeping food under lock and key, something so simple, was our first act of initiating force for social ends. And I think that when we do that, no matter how lofty the goal, and I'm not arguing from morality, I'm arguing from economics, that you know, clearly if I hit you in the face, you'll hit me back. If you pin me down and start to beat me in hopes that I'll become a primitivist, chances are it won't work, or I'll give you a conversion so you'll stop hitting me. But it's not genuine. And in terms of long-term societal stability, it will result in this kind of boom-bust society kind of cycle because everybody's scrambling for control of the centralized centralized violence. Normal violence, there is a certain amount of normal violence, just like there's love and there's nurturing, there's compassion, there's all these other great things too. But specifically, initiating force for social ends, it doesn't work. It can't work because it works against the grain of what normal human actions are like, which is that we resist when force is initiated upon us.
So then, is the resistance initiating force, or is the resistance the reply to force? Is it the natural outcome of the force?
I mean, I go around and around and around in my head about, you know, at what point, you know, if a guy goes out on the street and shoots a cop in the head in cold blood, could you get real broad and say, well, in the larger case, these institutions are already committing violence against us, so in this like more abstract case, he or she is just resisting that force. I think there's a lot of problems with that, specifically because the end result is increased state violence and oppression against people. And let me just say that, like, it's not that certain acts of violence aren't arguably warranted and aren't logical and aren't based on a rage that is very, very real and very authentic and very genuine and very warranted. But again, I'm not arguing for morality. I'm arguing against what's actually, I think, effective in terms of moving beyond civilization and the initiation of force being essential, being if not the central premise of civilization, being one of the fundamental premises of civilization. You know, we see it in democracy, and we see it in really brutal forms of government. So the initiation of force. So violence against each other, violence breeds violence. That's absolutely predictable. It happens all the time. We've seen it happen for thousands and thousands of years. So is it permissible and warranted and arguably all those things? I think so. But so is blowing up a dam, and I don't think that's a good idea either, because it's not going to change people. You know, because what we're calling for is a fundamental, like, if we're talking about anarchy and we're talking about, like, changing the world and changing society, what that calls for is changing people's minds.
I don't know if we are talking about those things all the time. I don't know if we are talking about a reliance upon changing mass society. Honestly, I don't think that that's number one realistic or fits within what my idea of what anarchism is. I don't think that changing, whether it's through coercion or through force or through clever propaganda and funny radio shows, I don't think that's necessarily fits within my idea of an anarchistic lifestyle. I don't think we should rely upon changing the masses. Let's not forget, the masses are the ones who have given us genocide. The masses are the ones who have given us ecocide. The masses, I mean, massive opinion doesn't really count for shit to me. You know, this book I'm reading right now, My Story is Told by Water by David James Duncan, talks about his appeal against public voice. And his appeal for that is to say, look, I never once had to get public opinion to plant a garden. I never once had to get public opinion to go fishing. I never once had to get public opinion to build a clothes hanger in my backyard. Like, if we can exist within our own homes and within our own neighborhoods and communities without the opinion of the masses, then why do we rely so much on the opinion of the masses when it comes to how badly we're destroying everything? You know, it's like people, it's a mass insanity. It's an insanity that's gripped us all. Would you go to an insane asylum to look for a solid opinion on how to hedge your funds? You know what I mean? Like, maybe. and you might luck out, but honestly, like, I'm not really dependent upon changing the minds and the hearts of the world, specifically when it comes to things like the Grand Coulee and the 14 other dams that have destroyed the Snake Columbia Riverway. I mean, if they would have gotten massive opinion, public opinion for putting those in from the people that lived there when they were putting them in, they would have never been able to put them in. But now we can't get them to go out because the public relies upon the electricity, the cheap electricity, and the cheap water to grow the cheap crops in a desert. I mean, people think of Oregon, they think it's a big green rainforest. Well, it is on our side of the mountain, but it's not on the other side of the mountain. Yet there are farmers growing huge crops of corn and potatoes and succulent plants in a desert. This is fucking stupid. And I think massive public opinion would say, I like potato chips, and I like them to be cheap. So if that's what we have to do, if that's the cost, then go for it. Well, then at that point, I stop caring what the masses think.
Well, but here's the thing is I understand what you're saying, but I think that you have to care about what people are thinking, because to continue all of this, to keep participating in the system, to keep casting votes, to keep meeting at protest lines and arguing, it calls for ideas. It calls for thoughts. And again, the people civilization at all costs because of an idea, a cultural meme that says we have to protect this at all costs, even if it means the end of our own existence. So in my opinion, the daunting task, especially of anarchists, is to do just that, is to start creating paradigm shift. I mean, that's what it's going to call for, because you can blow up as many dams as you want, and all those fucking people are going to work really hard to rebuild them. You can bring down as much shit as you want, but if you haven't changed the way people think, if you haven't worked to genuinely engender honest-to-God paradigm shifts, then those people are just going to build that same shit. They're just yeah, I know what you were cheering about. They're going to work really hard to rebuild it the second it's gone. I mean, that's why every time any country that when their state falls, very rarely do they remain stateless and do the people go about living a life of voluntary interaction.
Also, though, very rarely do they remain stateless because of the will of the people. They don't remain stateless because of the force and power of external government forces.
But that force and power is supported by people with the cultural meme that
not necessarily
is appropriate.
Not necessarily.
Absolutely.
Sometimes it comes at the passivity of the people, not at the will of the people.
Sure, but that still requires the same fundamental ideas, which is accepting this system as it is. You know,
no, it requires feeling powerless against this system. It doesn't require accepting it. It requires feeling powerless.
That's fine. That's an idea.
So
though.
Arguably then, well, logically, according to this train of thought, if blowing up a dam makes you feel empowered that somebody did that, could that then therefore lead to this cultural shift that you're talking about?
Not at all, because if you blow up a dam and you kill thousands of people, let's take this red herring scenario to its logical extreme.
When are thousands of people going to die in the blowing up of a dam?
If you blow up, well, I'm assuming that the people who live near the dam can't breathe underwater, so if water it covers up their town and anybody dies from it.
Well, that's exactly what happened when the dam went in. That's not what's going to remain after the dam goes out.
Sure.
It's not like the blowing up the dam is going to create the Washington
Absolutely.
State oceanic Gulf.
And if because people accepted the initiation of force when the dam was built, and they will continue to accept the initiation of force once it's blown up by anarchists, because what that action does...
It doesn't have to be blown up by anarchists.
Okay, it doesn't have to be by anarchists. It can just be by people who want to blow up a fucking dam.
Chances are, the anarchists, I know it's never going to get blown up by anarchists,
because
we can't even make it on time to a fucking...
We are lazy. Yeah. Anyways... What it does is it reaffirms that cultural meme, so nobody learns anything, and they go about to either hunt down the people who did it and kill them and imprison them, or work really hard to make sure the dam's rebuilt. It doesn't change. It's participating in civilization, as warranted as the action is, as badly as the dams need to come down. In my opinion, that kind of action, initiating force for social change, reaffirms civilization. It makes us active participants.
How long do you think it would take to convince through kind, loving measures, an entire populace that feeds upon the destruction of the Columbia waterway for these dams? They get their electricity from them. They get their daily existence and comfort. How many years do you think it would take to convince them? Because let me tell you this. In the 25 years that this dam system has been in play in its completion in the Snake in Columbia, we've lost hundreds of species. We've lost wild coho. They're gone. Forever. Now, this fish used to run so thick that it would make the entire waterway look like it was silver and red, and it would inspire trade and generations of indigenous peoples to come from as far as Costa Rica. This is pre-white industrial civilization. This is when the Nez Perce were there. Thousands upon thousands of people would come every year to see the salmon run because it was a holy event for them. It was a spiritual event. A lot of the creation myths of these peoples would say that we were birthed from the salmon folk, from the salmon people. And in 25 years, we've decimated the salmon population beyond repair at this point. Now, I say beyond repair because I'm a fatalist. Actuality is, if you leave nature to itself, it will repair itself. And if that's nature's go-to, is to constantly be in reparations. And our go-to is to constantly be destructive. We've just outweighed... And not our go-to as a human, our go-to as civilization. I want to clarify that. It's not our human nature to destroy everything.
I don't believe that. I don't believe that human nature is inherently fucked. I think that as babies, we are not fucked until TV and school systems and civilization get in there, and then we're fucked. And even then, it takes a lot of time to beat it into children to be unfree. I have two children. They're ages 4 and 5. I'm telling you right now, to manipulate the mind of children is not as simple as it might sound. And my kids are quick. My kids pick up on this shit. They see these commercials on billboards, and they pick up on it, and they fight against it. They know what's wrong. They don't grasp or understand the need for such destructive forces because they grasp and understand the love of the land base, because they've been experiencing the land base since birth, as opposed to experiencing the benefits, the so-called benefits of civilization. They experience the other end. And so their sense of entitlement is entitlement of land, not entitlement of destruction.
Well, and I mean, I also want to say that, I mean, we're up against like 10,000 years of this cultural meme being reinforced through generation after generation, 10,000 years. So how long will it change? How long will it take to create a paradigm shift that will affect billions of people? Real long time.
2012,
bitches. So 2 years. 2 years, paradigm shift, be there.
Which, by the way, if anybody's seen 2012, that film, we're talking a lot about films tonight, I guess because I've been lazy lately and I've been pirating a lot. I mean, not pirating, I've been renting movies a lot.
Borrowing them.
Yeah. At any rate, in the movie 2012, by the way, this is interesting, they say that these accords that were signed to create these ships that are needed in 2012 were signed after what happened in Vancouver in 2010. And so apparently there's some conspiracy theorists out there that say this is a prolific prophetic kind of voice saying that something's going to go down in Vancouver in 2010. Oddly enough, Vancouver in 2010 is seeing the decimation and destruction of indigenous lands for the Olympics. So maybe this is a prophetic voice. Right now we're seeing thousands of acres of old growth forests just be uprooted and destroyed for the building of these superplexes so Nike can come in and put their fucking logo on every person. In Vancouver, they've gone as far as to pass laws against using the 5 cock rings of death on a flag or a symbol if it's in any way against the Olympics. So you can't you can display the Olympic symbol in your window. Let's say Muddy Waters is there and they display an Olympic thing saying, "Yay, we're glad the Olympics is in Portland today." That's okay. If Muddy Waters did what Muddy Waters would do and put a sign up that said, "Get the fuck out of Portland, Olympics. We don't want you or your corporate sponsors," then they could be arrested and taken to jail according to this new law that was passed. And for anybody that doesn't understand why the Olympics is bad, it's not that we're against the sports, because I'm not. I don't really care. I think some of it's kind of fun and interesting sports-wise.
Yeah.
But what this is this is a huge global economic push to develop undeveloped lands. And bring in corporate powers to place themselves in the center of this and create a dependency upon what that corporation offers as it takes from the land what it wants and spits back nearly nothing to the indigenous peoples of that land. When it takes place in a city that's already developed like Atlanta, they displace 14,000 homeless people. And when you say homeless, there's people that live there without a house, but it's not as if they just wanted to move willy-nilly anywhere that the government would move them. They weren't given homes. They were just shipped out of their city, the city they knew, the city they loved, for whatever reason, the city they decided to stay in. It does this repeatedly. There's a blood trail behind it. So you can check that out at no2010.org to see what's going on up there right now in opposition to the Olympics.
And it's really interesting. So this is just one of the many things that we do to destabilize areas because, you know, this this whole idea of disaster capitalism is really true because what you is great profit to be made off destabilizing areas. And this is really interesting. So George W. Bush was recently made co-chair to Haiti's relief fund for the earthquake, which was pretty hilarious because
George Bush hates black people.
George Bush hates black people, A. And B, he cut off a ton of aid from Haiti in his first term. Bush Sr. and Clinton were both heavily involved in establishing coups in this country to replace leaders. And recently, Pat Robertson claimed that Haiti's earthquake was a result of them making a pact with the devil 200 years ago in order to enact. By the way, I'm against the initiation of force to enact change, but making a pact with the devil, I'm cool with it. I mean.
Well, and I'm also, I'm cool with punching Pat Roberts.
Yeah.
Or offing him.
You know, and especially, I'm going to go ageist on this one, especially because he's an old fucker.
It's just fucked.
I know, fucked. What, ageism or punching Pat Robertson?
I don't know which is more fucking kind of balance. I'm shitting in one hand, shitting in the other. Seeing which gets full first.
So I read this article at the Center for the Stateless Society. It's a really cool website. A lot of really interesting writing. The writer agreed that a pact had been made, but that the devil had been with all their different institutions, their political institutions that they put through, which I think is really interesting because it's one of the great ironies of the institutions of civilization as we know it. Is that they perpetuate the pain and suffering that they also proclaim to be helping us and saving us from. They create these things. You know, welfare state creates these things. The drug war creates these things. And dictators and such create these things, which are all voted on by people. And there's been nothing but Haiti on television for the past week. And just seeing the destruction, the devastation, and the people don't have an infrastructure present. This is really interesting, by the way. Apparently, within the past couple of years, some paperwork was done, and it turned out there was a huge chunk of politicians in Haiti's parliament who didn't exist, but were totally getting paid. But they actually did not exist. And these systems are there deliberately to make the owners of Nike rich, to make a very small portion of people very powerful. Because what's necessary in these environments is massive destabilization. So I think there's a lot of truth to this idea of disaster capitalism, where you actively create systems that create massive, massive destruction and destabilization, so that later these groups become dependent on aid from the very institutions who, you know, would seek to oppress them and keep them destabilized.
Sure, I think that we create a system that thrives on crisis in many ways. But the other thing that's really interesting, the flip side to that, is that looking at groups like Common Ground in New Orleans and Aftershock Action Alliance.
Anarchist organizations, yeah.
Yes, anarchist organizations. Common Ground Collective was the first group on the ground in the Lower Ninth Ward during Katrina, supplying medical supplies, supplying food, supplying guns that were tragically needed. It's tragic when a whole society needs a gun to stay alive, but they were needed, and Common Ground Collective, an anarchist, philosophically anarchist group, came together and stuck it out, and they fought off against the people they had to fight off were interesting. They had to fight against the Red Cross. They had to fight against the National Guards.
To remain
a safe space and a safe haven for people of the Lower Ninth, and they were the strongest and first on the ground during Katrina. Crisis offers up through analysis, we can talk about this, but in action, I've seen it. It offers up a chance to show the alternative. That's why anarchists, I think, are really great in times of crisis. We really do come together. I think that last week at Muddy Waters was a great example of people in a time of crisis coming together to help each other without necessarily personal gain in a financial sense or in any sense like that. It's coming together because the need is there and there's an ability to fill a need. And that's exactly what these companies offer us against. We got Muddy Waters in the news. Awesome. Talk about this in a second. One of the things that fits along with Naomi Klein's analysis and shock doctrine is what we see happening in Haiti right now. The job that I do to make money is a job where I go door to door and I talk to people about certain issues that affect specifically Portland, Oregon, and a special region. I don't really want to push the company I work for on the show because I don't advertise number one, even though I love what they do. They're really fucking amazing. But I also don't want to taint their good name by putting them on our show. Because I think people should be helping us do what we do. But I talk to people about donating to us, and everybody's saying, oh, I gave to Haiti. Understandably so. I'm not saying these people aren't deserving of help. The issue here is, when you're dumping your help into things like the Red Cross, it's not mutual aid. You're taking yourself out of the equation, number one. First and foremost, you aren't attached to the things that you're doing. Number two, you're dumping money into a corporation whose CEO has a private jet. We know this about the Red Cross. These CEOs, well, one of the ladies showed up, there was a CEO for the Red Cross, showed up to a benefit wearing a fur coat. Are you an idiot? Like, if you're going to be a fucking pedantic, opportunistic prick, at least don't show it off in public where the cameras are. But this person did that. And that's because they've come to the point where they feel so self-important that they think that what they're doing deserves them the right to, and has earned them the right to have all these riches. So we see all this money flooding into Haiti, and it's going into companies like this, but what these companies are doing are setting up inways and leads for corporations to come down and place in large factories to be production-based factories to repair the broken economy of Haiti, as if they're coming in like saviors on white horses, sweeping in to be the savior at the large rate of $1.80 a day in pay for 18 hours of work to the people of Haiti. These companies are going to be feasting on this like vultures. Another thing, I just typed in before we started the show really quick, companies profiting from Haiti crisis, and the first thing that popped up was something I hadn't even thought about, was the massive amount of money that credit card companies are making right now from people making donations on their credit cards and people shipping packages using their credit cards as opposed to using cash or other direct forms of economic transfer. They're raking in billions off of the goodwill of people who don't know any better than to use credit cards to give money to the Red Cross. And this is where we see something that starts off being so untainted. It's the idea of help. It's the idea of people are in time of need. Right, and that goes back to an anarchist philosophy of mutual aid. Helping those in need because there's a time when you're going to be in need. Awesome. And it's tainted and distorted and destroyed. Here we go. The article is on Huffington Post, so I don't know how much you want to trust these ideas. Huffington Post sometimes seems to be a huff and a puff and they'll blow your house down post. Fairy tales. But there's some good articles on here occasionally. This one's called, As Wallets Open for Haiti, Credit Card Companies Take a Big Cut. And that's not meaning they're losing money. That means that they're getting a big cut of the money that's going into Haiti. And these, by the way, these same credit card companies are financiers by the same big banks on Wall Street that received billions of dollars in bailout taxes, only to turn around and give that money as bonuses. These are the same credit card companies that have huge stake in the occupied lands of Palestine that we call Israel. Huge amounts of money get funneled in by these credit card companies to help fund these occupations of indigenous lands. And the reason for that is because these are untapped economic resources where they can one of the tactics used is they would bring in South America, these financiers would pay for people to load trucks up with clothing and food and water and take it to indigenous peoples who are having a rough couple seasons due to the droughts caused by the decimation of the rainforest. So they would truck all these goods and services into these people, hand them out willy-nilly, here, take this, take your shirt, and then the next day they would show up with a bill for all of the goods and services they provided to that village. And they would say, oh, well, but wait a minute, you all took these shirts, I mean, you all took our water and you all took our food. That's not free. You have to pay for it. Tell you what, you don't have any money. I understand. Who would you be, Boogaloo? Whatever it is, language you speak, I got it. You don't have any money. Tell you what, we're just going to take your land, and we're gonna deforest it, and that's fine. And that's how these companies come in, take over, and just destroy. It's through crisis that they come together. Let's also not forget that Haiti is the land of revolt. Haiti's revolutions started in the 1800s. Actually, started in the 1500s. 16th century was the first revolt in Haiti, slave revolt. So I think it's going to be interesting to see if any radical changes are going to be made from the ground up in Haiti.
Well, you know, one of the things I just read about today was that so far they're estimating 50,000 dead. You know, it's going to be more than that, but that's so far confirmed. And one of the big articles I read is that despite the fact that people are starting to fight over food and water, despite the fact that there's still a sad absence of aid flowing in, the people there are I mean, it's really incredible, like lone doctors wandering the streets looking for anyone that they might help. Stories of, you know, people lighting up an area with their cell phones to try and dig rubble out to pull someone out. You know, it's really amazing what the people there are having to do in the absence of all this stuff. But again, this you know, this goes back to you know, something that's going on in Portland right now, and this does relate, I promise, is City Commissioner Randy Leonard. He's the kind of de facto mayor in Portland, and he has a Portland Hit Squad. And what they do is they go around to businesses they don't like, and they've gone around to some apartments to do these kind of on-the-spot searches to make sure they're within code. And it essentially amounts to a group of individuals who go into a place, flash their identification, and hand out citations. They make a ton of money from it. And to me, that's an awful lot like a group of mobsters going around to collect. But it's all under the guise of, you know, we're helping people. And matter of fact, there's even testimonials from people who, some of the individuals who live at these apartments are saying, you know, yeah, no, life is better for me since Randy Leonard's hit squad came through here and made these guys tighten up their code. And so the illusion will persist that services have been provided and they're helping us. I'm of the opinion that part of the reason that aid is so waning for these people in need, in the same way that it is for Haiti and the same way it was with Katrina, is to further engender this kind of collective Stockholm syndrome where these companies will now be able to come in and, quote, improve things. And then the cultural meme will be more accepting. It'll be like, oh, okay, well, these noble capitalists came in and helped us. And, yeah, we had to pay some stuff back. That's a drag. Do you want to come up? So we have an audience member. You want to come up? Okay, so I'm going to switch places with you.
George Bush was the man that specifically said, please send tanks. Yeah. He was the one who said that.
Wow, so we got a Republican president in government who's encouraging people to send cash. He's over here was telling us that he saw a report that Obama called together like a meeting of the Knights of the Round Table of sorts with ex-presidents to talk about what to do for Haiti, and George Bush was saying, telling people to please send cash. You know, what's interesting, yeah, cash is money is needed in times of crisis because we live in a system that runs on that bullshit idea of money. But one of the first things that got put out there for what we need, what was needed, the people said, what we need now in New Orleans is guns. It's guns. We need guns and we need ammunition because we're being shot at. We're being shot at and our homes are being taken over by National Guard, by militias, and by Blackwater. They're coming into neighborhoods that aren't that affected, commandeering our homes and shooting at us, especially if they were black. They were getting shot at, and they were told they were being they were protecting the streets and saving it from looters. Well, you know, you don't have looters in a situation of defense like that. You have people that are surviving, and if Katrina had hit in Massachusetts or New Hampshire, we definitely would see people surviving, not people looting. That's the term. It would have been the same activities. But the news would say that these people were doing what they had to do to survive. 740, you're on the line. Tell us where you're calling from.
It's Tony in Ohio, man. What's going on?
Hey, who is this?
It's Tony in Ohio, man. What's going on? Oh,
hey, Tony. Welcome back.
Hey, everybody, this is Tony in Ohio. Tony, Tony's been a longtime listener on the show, and he has his own show as well. What's going on with you, Tony? What's happening?
Nothing, just hanging out, listening to the show.
Word.
All right. anything you want to add to the conversation or bring up a new topic for us to discuss?
I don't know, man. Just listening in, and you brought me in like a bad moment there for a second. Sorry about that. I was caught off guard.
Oh, that's okay. I tell you what, I'm gonna leave you on the line. Pipe in whenever you want. Your line's gonna stay open.
Okay, man.
Okay, cool. So what else was there to talk about?
Well, a good lead into what you were saying about specifically blacks being targeted in the South at Katrina. So currently the African American jobless rate is at a 25-year high, 17% to 20% in at least 5 states. But the open market estimate is always higher than that. So whenever you hear national unemployment is 10%, think more like 20, because those numbers aren't they don't include things like a friend of mine who is only working about 4 to 6 hours a week. She's not counted in those effects. So really, numbers.
They
are
also don't include people that haven't been a part of the job force before,
right?
Part of the legal job force. Mm-hmm. They only include people who've lost work
right.
in the unemployment
and who've applied for benefits post job. And you know, again, this is just something that I constantly go back to because we have services in place. Like unemployment and welfare and things like that that are supposed to be this kind of, that are an illusion, a skewing of what mutual aid really is. Because these programs are specifically, in my opinion, and I might be getting a little bit too conspiracy theory, but I don't give a shit. I fucking believe it's Sasquatch. I really, really do. I believe in Bigfoot. I believe in UFO. I'm so into UFOs. Like the
seriously other... though.
No. Anyway, so
seriously though, he is like we used to watch a crop circle documentary.
Yeah, like when last time when Michael was
How did they electromagnetically shift the DNA?
Yes. I have this killer crop circles documentary at home. It's so badass, dude. So anyways,
this is like the old days.
This is totally like the old days. What was I talking about? Help me out, audience.
Obama,
the jobless rate, fucking welfare,
mutual aid.
It's a skewing, thank you, of natural human tendencies, you know what I mean, which is to share and help one another, and not necessarily out of this high kind of morality thing, necessarily. I mean, that's there, sure. But really, out of just that's kind of our more natural way to be. But these programs that are in place are meant to create marginalized demographics of poverty and crime, because when you can do that via the welfare state, via the war on drugs, via public education, you create predictable demographics that reaffirm the need for you to exist. And by you, I'm talking about the politicians, who the individuals who comprise the political machine, and the capitalists who take advantage of it. Is to create destabilization, to create a need for you to be there in the first place. And it's a self-justification process, and it's a cycle, and it goes around and around and around and around. So when 40% of a specific demographic is unemployed, their programs are succeeding. The programs that they've started are a resounding success. The prison industry is a beautiful success at legitimizing slavery. Slavery never went away, gang. Yeah, I know 600,000 people died during the Civil War to purportedly get rid of it, is what we've been told. But it never went away. It was just legitimized and turned into a really, really profitable, really lucrative business. 1 in 100 people in America is in a jail cell, is in a cage. That's more than China. And those people are forced to make shit for like Hewlett-Packard and other companies. The prison industry is and these other industries create predictable demographics so that they can profit to a great extent.
Popping your peas.
Popping my peas.
Yeah, I mean, the whole third shift at Jack in the Box is there on work release. So
nobody would work there by choice, third shift. Don't lie to me, Jack in the Box. I know that your PO makes you work there.
I mean, these are the critiques that we see, but I think that a lot of times when we talk about theory and we talk about the philosophies behind these things, we tend to get really exaggerated and talk about the large-scale aspects of it, and then we try to talk about bringing it back home on a local level and how it affects us. I think what we really need more of is we really need more of a localized resistance based in the knowledge of your land base, based in the knowledge of not necessarily what we see as pressing needs politically within our communities, but just things that we can do to become a stronger sect of people. And when I say that, I'm not speaking tribally, I'm not speaking elitist. I'm saying that people who have these ideas, people who do share these ideas with us already, can feel the daily weight of despair kind of lift. Know that you're doing what you can. And I think that's the things we need to be working on, are fighting local fights. Because it is a monster, it is a behemoth, and it is global, but it requires the subjugation of small towns and small communities and small groups of people. And interestingly enough, it's those small groups of people that can stop these machines. And for instance, the LNG pipeline coming in from Astoria down through Oregon, cutting across Mount Hood National Forest, liquefied natural gas, the premise involved in saying natural gas is already oxymoronic. It's absolutely ridiculous. Liquefied natural gas is anything but natural, number one. Number two, it's not useful. We don't need it. It's not an energy source that we depend upon until we run out of oil, and then we're turning to these alternative energy sources, which is just another way for us to find an exploitative use of land base somewhere to profit the few. It's the same people that are going to profit from this that profited from oil, which the same people that profit from plastic. It's all these same fuckers. This in particular, though, what's interesting about this pipeline is it not only cuts across a shit ton of waterways that supply clean drinking water to Oregonians, but it's the purpose of it is to bring liquefied natural gas to California. California vetoed having the pipeline in California because it's environmentally destructive. So they bring it to Oregon. And Oregon has got a higher unemployment rate than California, and this is promising about 1,000 jobs that will last about 3 months. So the temporary payoff is going to be you get a job where you get to clean brush. And when I say clean brush, I mean you get to knock down 700 acres of old growth forest. That's what cleaning brush is to these companies. Getting through this stuff is it's taking out old growth forest, burying a few dozen streams and waterways, putting a pipe across the Clackamas River, which gives clean water to 200,000 Oregonians. This is what their ideas of temporary work is valid to bring this pipeline through is. On top of that, bringing it to California, this is ridiculous. This is why do we want to bring anything through Oregon to California? Why do we give a shit about what Californians need when they have the highest consumption rate for energy in the country? The only place that could possibly beat them is Las Vegas, Nevada, and it's definitely misplaced energy use in Nevada. It's the use of the Rio Grande River and the Colorado rivers that they give energy to Nevada. So they already stole water from that water. That water doesn't even touch the ocean anymore. Rio Grande means big river, people. It's not anymore. It's gone. It's a fucking dry riverbed. You know, they have big rains called monsoons in the Southwest, and when it rains like this, cars oftentimes get washed out because they're trying to cross these riverbeds, they call them riverbeds, and they're on maps. They look like riverbeds, but don't take a fishing pole because it's just big fucking ditches. And that's because of the misappropriation of these services that the Earth provides, not to us, but to all living things. And we're doing this now artificially. We are artificially moving liquefied natural gas that we're importing from other countries, which means, let me take out the language of importing from other countries, that we're stealing from indigenous lands in other parts of the world, decimating and destroying their land base to bring liquefied natural gas to Arnold Schwarzenegger so he can run his fucking Humvee with it, so he can say it's run on biodiesel. Get down! Get out! But anyway, we're on some rants right now. The audience, you guys look kind of bored, and I understand that because we always had a guest here, and we've been really entertaining. This is what the show used to consist of, is Travis would be in his house, and I'd be in mine, and we'd be talking on our phones, and chances are we'd be in underwear or less, eating snack food and just talking shit for 2 hours. So what I am going to do is I'm going to take it back to an old tradition, and I'm going to play This Week in Radical History.
We should play that. We have another clip to play.
Okay. Well, this is This Week in Radical History by Mike Cannon.
Love you, Mike Cannon.
Yeah, we miss Mike Cannon a lot. So, Mike, if you're out there listening, give us a call. By the way, the call lines are open, 646-200-3974. But during this clip, they will not be open. It's about 17 minutes long. It's called This Week in Radical History for the week of January 17th.
Gonna rise up and take what's there. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talk about the revolution.
This Week in Radical History for the week starting January 19th. Inspiration came from the Slingshot organizer, and more radical info can be found at the Daily Bleed website.
Yo, check this out, man.
There is something going on in the east side.
The kids are now moving back into the street.
For every Martin they cut down, there must be 100 Martins to step into his shoes. Hey!
This Week in Radical History for January 19th, 1808, anarchist Lysander Spooner lives. Spooner set up a private postal service so successful that the federal government decided to outlaw it. Author of No Treason, The Constitution of No Authority, arguing the Constitution and the basic assumption of government is binding to no one. This book was described as possibly the most subversive document ever printed in this nation.
The city of Taos, New Mexico was awash with blood on this day in 1847. Just a year after being vacated by the Spanish and transferred to U.S. control, some of the Native Americans in the area were allied with the Mexican population there and had fought alongside them against the Spanish. To them, the land in question was both their ancestral home and part of Mexico. And so on this day, a group of Native Americans and Mexican nationals confronted the newly appointed governor of New Mexico, Charles Bent. An altercation erupted and Bent was killed, as were several of the Native Americans, who then went on a rampage targeting any white settlers they found. The conflict, which lasted for over a month and which took some 1,500 federal troops to suppress, was known as the Taos Uprising.
Also on January 19, 1892 in Cuba, anarchists celebrate the first Cuban Regional Congress. The anarchists recommended the Cuban working class join the ranks of revolutionary socialism and take the path of independence. In a manifesto, they present a phrase which has passed into history. Quote, "It would be absurd for one who inspires individual freedom to oppose the collective freedom of the people." Spanish authorities would then suppress the Congress, close down the anarchist press, declare the alliance illegal, and deport or imprison the best-known anarchist participants. Also on January 19, 1915, world-famous labor organizer and songwriter Joe Hill is arrested in Salt Lake City, Utah. Joe Hill is convicted on trumped-up murder charges. His last words to his comrades was, "Don't mourn, organize."
The U.S. Geological Survey reported on this day in 1920 that the United States' yet-to-be-extracted oil reserves would only be sufficient to meet the country's demands at the levels of that day for the next 20 years. The sizes of the known U.S. oil fields and the difficulty of extracting the oil using the methods that recurred at that time informed the survey's findings, and the agency warned that the U.S. would soon become dependent on oil from other countries if it did not develop alternative forms of energy generation. The agency's warning was correct, and although new oil fields had been discovered and extraction technologies have improved, the U.S. currently imports more than 60% of the oil it consumes and uses 26% of the world's energy output while having only 5% of the world's population and only 3% of the world's remaining oil reserves. This Day in History is a production of the Neighborhood Network in Columbus, Ohio. I'm Evan Davis.
Crystal Graham. On this day, January 20th, in 1887, the Navy, with assistance from the U.S. Senate, leased Pearl Harbor in Hawaii as a naval base. Hawaii was still an independent kingdom and was just forced to adapt the Bayonet Constitution, a measure that stripped the king's powers and gave voting rights to Americans and European immigrants. Leasing Pearl Harbor secured American interests on the Hawaiian Islands and American dominance in the Pacific. In the 10 years that followed, the U.S. government overthrew the Hawaiian government, expanding Pearl Harbor into a state-of-the-art naval reservation and increased the military force in other island nations, such as Cuba and the Philippines. Ah, U.S. imperialism at its finest. Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you to level at the past, slip away.
Also on January 20th, 1902, Army Brigadier General Jacob Smith asked the Marine Corps to assist them to help subdue the Filipino population on the island of Samar. Major Weller and his Marine Battalion were given the assignment. After a bunch of atrocities, Major Weller would be brought up on war criminal charges. Even though General Smith reported that, Weller said the following, quote, "I want no prisoners. I wish you to kill and burn. The more you kill and burn, the better it will please me. I want all prisoners killed who are capable of bearing arms in actual hostilities against the United States." Unquote. Anyone up to 10 years old. The Marines executed his orders. Despite the general's testimony, Major Weller would be acquitted of all charges and eventually retire as United States Marine Corps general himself. Also on January 20, 1929 in Manchuria, the Korean anarchist guerrilla general Kim Zhao-jin is assassinated while doing some repair work on a rice mill. The Korean Anarchist Federation in China was formed in April of 1924. Over 2 million Koreans were living in Manchuria, and the Korean anarchists were very active and influential among them. We are everywhere. Also on this date in 1960 in the Belgian Congo, Patrice Lumumba, first democratically elected president, is sentenced to 6 months on trumped-up charges, and the CIA has him murdered in 1961 by order of President Ike Eisenhower himself. He is shot, transported in a CIA car, and then his body is dumped in an acid bath. Also on this date in 1981, minutes after the inauguration of acting President Reagan, 52 Americans held captive in Iran for 444 days are released following an agreement in which the United States agrees to return $8 billion in frozen assets to Iran. Later it was revealed that the release was delayed until the inauguration in a PR ploy orchestrated by the Reagan handlers to make him look good. What a hero. Also on January 20, 1996 in Palestine, Yasser Arafat wins 88% of the vote in the first Palestinian elections. Israel and the United States, under Bush, campaigns of, quote, democracy, unquote, do everything in its power, short of assassination, to topple him, including Israel's support of Hamas. Last year, Hamas wins the Palestinian elections, and Israel and the United States, under Bush Jr., do everything they can to topple Hamas. To this date, Israel is in violation of more UN resolution regarding Palestinians than any other country's violations, almost three times as many Israeli violations than the excuse that was used to invade Iraq. And the beat and the beatings and the killings go on.
And on this day in 2001 and 2005, inauguration ceremonies were held in Washington, D.C., acknowledging George Bush in the role of American president. In 2001, the true winner of the previous year's presidential election had yet to be determined, when after an embarrassingly close race in which Bush's Democratic challenger Al Gore declined to differentiate his platform from Bush's, the vote tally in Florida remained too close to call and was widely disputed. Gore was then later shown to have won Florida's popular vote, but that evidence was suppressed when the U.S. Supreme Court halted the recount in that state. Gore conceded prematurely in 2001, but not as hastily as Bush's 2004 challenger, John Kerry. There, in another embarrassingly close race, evidence of electoral fraud in Ohio suggested the election results there may have been fictitiously skewed in Bush's favor. Kerry, however, conceded the day after the votes were cast.
Ah, as Stalin once said, those who cast the vote decide nothing. Those who count the votes decide everything. This week in Radical History for January 21st, 1801, a mysterious fire sweeps the offices of the Department of the Treasury, destroying books and papers. After Republicans demand proof that the expenditures of Timothy Pickering, a recently replaced Federal Secretary of War, could be properly accounted for. Also on January 21st in 1920, the Palmer Red Raids begin, targeting labor activists and radicals from the United States government repression. Attorney General Palmer orders the roundup of all suspected and are prosecuted and deported where possible. Thousands of people arrested nationwide sweep. Most arrests are illegal, without warrants or justification. Also on this date in 1968, four thermonuclear bombs lost when a B-52 crashes in North Star Bay, Greenland. There are reports of over 200 nuclear bombs lost over the years, and those are the ones that we know of. Also on this date in 1977, President Jimmy Carter issues unconditional pardons to most Vietnam draft resistors on his first full day in office. This pardon affects between 100,000 and 500,000 people. Wouldn't it be very nice if Obama pardons the roughly 2,000 Iraq Vetch war resistors now living underground in Canada? I ain't going to hold my breath. This week in Radical History for January 22, 1903 in Panama, U.S. gets a 99-year lease and sovereignty over the Panama Canal after engineering a coup in favor of U.S. takeover.
The U.S. government has done some bad things over the years and will almost certainly continue to do them in the years ahead. Foreign policy has very little to do with morality. And as long as any action can be justified by explaining that it was performed in the national interest, that will continue to be the case.
Also on January 22, 1905 in Russia, Bloody Sunday, a massacre of demonstrators in St. Petersburg. Troops open fire on 100,000 workers, women and children. Over 1,000 be killed, and it is the beginning of the first Russian Revolution. Tomorrow the anarchists form part of the first Soviet, created to assist victims of the repression. This year sees a widespread of anarchist movement, which later will be suppressed by the Bolsheviks.
You keep saying you got something for me, something you call love, but confess, you've been a-messin' where you shouldn't have been a-messin', and now someone else is getting all your best. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you.
On January 22, 1966, Frank Sinatra's daughter, Nancy, releases her biggest hit, These Boots Are Made for Walkin'. 14 weeks on the chart, it goes to number one for 1 week next month. Years later, the Federals will blast it over and over and over again for the Wackos at Waco.
You keep saying when you ought to be a-changin'. Now what's right is right, but you ain't been right yet. These boots are made for walking, and that's just what they'll do. One of these days these boots are gonna walk all over you. Are you ready, boots? Start walking.
This is your Radio Roots reporter, Arturo Contreras. On this day, January 22nd, in 1973, the U.S. Supreme Court delivered its famous ruling on Roe v. Wade. By determining that state laws banning abortion were in violation of an individual's constitutional right to privacy, the court's decision served to legalize abortion as a woman's fundamental right and personal choice. There was a huge pro-life backlash directly following Roe v. Wade as religious right-wing fanatics increased their efforts to terrorize pro-abortion health clinics and the women who were seen entering them. You know, it's kind of ironic when you consider all the health clinics that were bombed. The pro-lifers killing people and all? Yeah, I said it. This is your free speech educator reminding you, never let the past slip away.
Lastly, for January 22nd, 1991 in El Salvador, 15 villagers massacred by U.S.-supported government troops.
And so we give support to repressive governments in South Korea and Brazil and Chile because it is in our national interest to do so. We will supply sophisticated weapons to backward countries and betray an entire people like the Kurds, all because it is in our national interest. What may be difficult to accept is that there's nothing new about that. In fact, it's what we hire our Secretary of State and our Foreign Service to do for us. The myth is that since the First World War, we were ever able to conduct our foreign policy any other way. The United States is a superpower with enormous and divergent interests that it is committed to protect. And at best it is naive, at worst hypocritical, that they don't understand what's involved in that harsh reality. I'm Ted Koppel in New York.
This week in Radical History for January 23rd, 1870, the Baker's Massacre. The military, headed by Baker, receives a scouting report that a group of Indians led by Mountain Chief has camped along a river. They attack the site at Willow Rounds, but Mountain Chief had been warned and left the area. So Baker's men instead ended up attacking a camp of Chief Heavy Runner, who had enjoyed friendly relations with the white men. Although Baker's scouts had reportedly warned him that he was about to attack the wrong camp, he proceeded anyway against the protest of those scouts. As the men of the camp were mostly out hunting, the raid was a massacre of mostly women and children. This crime would be left out of the papers, and Baker would retire with distinction. Lastly, on January 23, 1942, in Poland, Jewish ghettos in Warsaw rise to resist the fascists. Statistically, during World War II, the Jews who resisted lived on an average longer than those who did not. Yet they wonder why the people of Gaza resist. This has been This Week in Radical History, produced from the mobile fortress of Glee Glee Studios. Special thanks again this week to both Radio Roots crew from WBAI in New York and the Neighborhood Network of Columbus, Ohio, whose audio I borrowed for the show. This week being the last week of our beloved dictator GW, I leave you now with a little ditty about just one of the many atrocities he has done in our name. Note that this last little piece both Bush and Charles Manson speak. Now play this game with me and try to discern whose voice is saying what. Thanks for listening this week in Radical History, and as always and forever, I'm yours in a struggle, Mike Cannon.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. For not doing enough. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then I would have felt like I'd really offered society something. You've got it stuck in your brain that I'd love to do that. What do you want to call me a murderer? But I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do with tinsel and the real world who I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, they could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat, terrorists, dangerous, die.
There are some who
I feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, January 19th, 2009, 4,248 United States military personnel died in Iraq since the start of the invasion.
Over 40,000 have been wounded, many sustaining major life-changing injuries such as amputations.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator. Just so long as I'm the dictator. Just so long as I'm the dictator. I'm the dictator. I'm the dictator. I'm the dictator. Dictator. Dictator.
All right, so that's This Week in Radical History by Mike Cannon. That's from last year. Cannon, for obvious reasons, has not been able to do his beloved show this year after having all of his equipment stolen by the pigs, which this is interesting. I read a post from the other day. Did you read this post? Apparently, the Pittsburgh DA said that the reason that they haven't been able to get into the computers that they stole from the people at the I'm blanking right now. The computers that they stole from the Twitterists, I'll just leave it at that, is because apparently they are booby-trapped to self-destruct. This is what the Pittsburgh DA has warned against, that if we open these hard drives to retrieve information, they will self-destruct. Awesome. Wow. I love that Data from the Goonies has been working with Anarchist Collective.
Booby traps. I said a booby traps. That's what I said.
and while we're plugging things, I keep meaning to do this. I want to just give a shout out to my boys at ifaq.us, ifac.us. It's another anarchist radio show that plays midweek. They've been plugging the hell out of our show. So that's ifaq.us. They have a lot of funny news stories that you might not hear elsewhere. One of the ones they talked about this week was a hypnotist in training who accidentally hypnotized himself for like 5 hours when he was practicing in front of the mirror. So it's pretty awesome. They do a lot of funny shit. And also, the Bottom Up Radical Network, the collectivized version of our news show, if you can call this shit news, is up and running. We have a Ning Network. What is the official address, Rabble Rouser?
It's bottomupradicalnetwork.ning.com. That's bottomupradicalnetwork.ning.com.
It's a social networking site that a lot of people are using, and you can post a lot of blogs. We really encourage everyone to get involved. Write it down. If you're listening to this now, go to the site. Register. It's free. You can post any of your ideas and thoughts to it. Rabble Rouser and I will soon get off of our asses and start putting up some original writings by ourselves as we go back and forth. And we really want to encourage all of our listeners to get connected to us and start putting up your ideas.
It's completely decentralized. Once you have an account on there, which is free to do, and you're a part of the Ning Network with Bottom Up Radical Network, you can post at will whatever you'd like to post. There's nobody going to stop you from posting anything. No matter how heinous and retarded you might sound.
Yeah, exactly. Developmentally delayed.
So lines are going to be open, 646-200-3974. And during the break there, when This Week in Medical History was playing, G20 and I got a chance to discuss with a few others what we might talk about tonight. And we were thinking it might be interesting to open the debate up and keep the debate going of nonviolence versus violence in resistance and in other paths of life. So if anybody would like to partake in that discussion from the audience, just walk on up, and you have to talk into these microphones until we figure out another way, until we have more microphones. But if you're calling in, or if you're in the chat room or listening through the interwebs, give us a ring, 646-200-3974. We don't really have any structured way that we're going to do this, but I guess we could just structure it as a point-counterpoint. Kind of debate.
Word.
Let's let G20 hit it first, because he makes some sensible arguments.
Okay, well, my position is on, I'm not a pacifist. I in no way, shape, or form. I believe in, I'm a full supporter of guns. I think guns are cool. And in fact, one of my favorite writers out there right now is George Donnelly over at Open Evolution. Writes a blog, and he's just got the sweetest face in the whole wide world. He's just like this rosy-cheeked, smiley guy, and he carries a gun with him. He's got a concealed weapons permit. He takes it with him to the bank. He gets fucked with by the cops all the time because he carries a gun. I'm not a pacifist. I respect that kind of action. That's just not. I don't advocate it per se, but I do have a lot of respect for it. Particularly the kind of violence that I'm specifically opposed to, as I said earlier in the show, is the initiation of force as the means to social ends. And I don't argue from a moral perspective, I argue from an economic perspective, that simply logically, it doesn't make sense to try and accomplish a genuine shift in a person by forcing them to do so. It's never worked for politics, it doesn't work for religion, and it certainly doesn't work for anarchism, anarchism especially. And I posted a thing on my Facebooks earlier this week. It was kind of a funny picture of a pen that said, Che killed people, you trendy douchebag. And it's not that that there aren't forms that, you know, it's like when Trejo, what did he do exactly, Rob Rouser?
Trey,
what was he put in jail for?
Trey was arrested for various eco-sabotage.
And I'm not, when people blow up SUVs, you know, they go to a party, they go, I don't have any problem with that. I don't argue against it. I don't take some like hardcore proprietarian view and say, well, you've destroyed the corporatist property. That's not cool. It's completely warranted and completely logical, and you can make plenty of fine, level-headed arguments in support of it. Unfortunately, what it does is it creates a paradigm wherein people just feel like the ideas are being shoved down their throat. And again, that's what coercion for social means does, is it skews your message. And while I believe that the action is warranted and arguable and logical, and I can even kind of sort of get behind it, ultimately it can't accomplish the ends that it intends to, simply because the reaction to the initiation of force is to initiate force back. It's like the idea of democracy being nothing but a scramble for the gun. And like this, one of the propositions in Oregon right now is to tax corporations more. And while I'm like, okay, fine, it's not going to do anything. It's only going to go back and forth. Eventually what they'll do is they'll get some legislation passed that will benefit them. Then the people will vote to, and it'll go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and nothing will ever happen in terms of real shift in consciousness or paradigm shift or whatever. So I'm not a pacifist. I'm not an advocate. And when I say nonviolence, I'm arguing not from morality. I'm arguing from economics, which is that it's an inefficient way to go about things long term, simply because people's natural reaction is to return the initiation of force. And I know that sounds dry and it's not very emotional, but it is the facts, and it is, given 10,000 years of data, this is particularly how people act when you punch them in the face. If you punch someone in the face, they'll punch you back.
Okay, so the logical argument that you place is that violence begets violence, and initiation of force is the root of force. That force does not exist unless it's initiated. That makes sense. That's a logical rule of nature, that something cannot exist unless it's created in some fashion. Where I lose you in your argument of logic that if we use violence, it will be used against us, my argument obviously is that, well, what's the threshold then? How much violence are we supposed to accept before we do, according to the logical lens of violent begetting violence, fight back with violent measures? How many times are we supposed to take our lashings? How many cheeks do we have, for our Christian listeners out there, that we can turn? I don't see any argument that holds water in saying that violence begets violence. I would say that if a rapist is killed in the act of raping, that rapist will no longer rape, because that rapist is stopped. That rapist is dead. I would say that the logical ends of violent resistance would be to shrug off the oppressive hold
of the forces that are oppressing you. It's to, number one, specifically in cases of groups of people who have been under the arm of violent oppression for so long that it seems overpowering to the point where any violence that they enact will just bring the state's violence harder against them, which is pretty much all of us at this point live in a situation where that's true. A cop comes, drags you out of your car and kicks the shit out of you. It might get on the news. A cop pulls you over and you kick the shit out of that cop, you're going to have 12 other cops dragging you to the ground, beating you, possibly killing you, putting you in prison for a long time, thereby disrupting the natural life force that you have. That's the oppressive arm of the state. Now, when that fails to exist in a way that is logical in that argument is when the violence of the oppressed can successfully shrug off the oppressor. Yeah, Che did kill people, you trendy douchebag. I absolutely agree. Che not only killed violent oppressors, but he also killed innocent people. He also executed anarchists. He executed many anarchists because they didn't fit along his party program. The lesson learned there is not to use violence in revolution. The lesson is don't be a dogmatic shit heap. Don't go killing people just because they disagree with you. I mean, that's a lesson that we all know. We all understand that lesson quite clearly. The difference in my disagreeing with an oppressive force such as Monsanto is that I don't just disagree on a philosophical level. I am being forced to eat the shit that they create on a daily basis. In fact, not just me, but everybody in this country and on this planet is being forced to reap the havoc that they have sown. They've created this environment where their oppression is commonplace. And it's every day. And it's not going to stop. The destructive force of GMO crops will continue until those GMO crops are eradicated. In invasive species, if anybody that's into permaculture understands, the Himalayan blackberry, once it takes root, will take over and choke out the underlying fauna of a forest. That just happens. The way to get rid of that is to violently eradicate Himalayan blackberry. Now, am I resorting to saying that the oppressive forces of human beings are as dehumanized as blackberry? No, not at all. I am, however, saying that when I was a fat kid in school and I got picked on by a couple guys and I busted one of the guys in the face with my skateboard, I didn't get picked on by those guys anymore. And maybe it was because I scared them. Maybe it was because I earned some kind of machismo respect from their douchebag jock date rapist minds. I don't know why they chose not to pick on me anymore, but I know that I was no longer the kid that got picked on. I know for a fact that those kids lived to either reap what they've sown from other people or they've changed. Am I saying the oppressor's going to change because we use violence against them? Again, no. I happen to believe that the oppressive forces that we see at play now will never change. They will never stop. They won't stop because they think it is their God-given right to take all that they want. They honestly believe this. This is at the root of their philosophy. The philosophy is the root of their actions, and their action is the root of our oppression. So how do we stop that? Do we stop that by chanting peacefully and loving them? Well, our love for them will love us to death. Our love for them will take us to a point where we are non-existent because our love for them is a love for what they love, and that is destruction. I don't love destruction. I am not against life in any way whatsoever. And when I'm talking about using violence in a way that protects life, I think that that's a loving statement of life. I would say that when we're talking about the means of production and consumption that civilization is and requires being the most destructive force in history on this planet, which it is, that's not an argument that can be made against. You can't make a solemn argument that civilization has not been the most destructive force on this planet because 50 species a day on average, that's fucking destruction at its root. I mean, that's the epicenter of destruction. That's the thunderdome of destruction. I mean, this is the Super Bowl of fucking shit up. It's civilization. So to say that I would like to stop that destruction at the cost of maybe a few CEOs, at the cost of maybe a few commandeering armies, at the cost of maybe a guy who drives a tank into the house of a family that's trying to reside peacefully, that sucks that I have come to the point where we brought to that, but that's the point that we exist in. And I think that it's blind faith that stops people from that, and blind faith is not a good faith in this case. Blind faith in this case will keep you blind and keep you led right into the cattle stalls, into a Holocaust. And it'll be a Holocaust not just of our lives, but it'll be a Holocaust of the entire planet. We're seeing this. It's not, this isn't mumbo jumbo. This isn't conspiracy theory. This is fact. We are seeing the unbridled destruction of every living species on this planet, including the oppressive forces. It's not as if these assholes have made spaceships that'll take them away to another planet yet. I don't know. But as far as I know, they breathe the same fucked up air that I breathe. They drink the same fucked up water that I drink, and they're going to eat the same GMO shit for dinner that I eat. So I would say that using violence to stop this machine is imperative. And it's not imperative that every single person uses violence in that way. That's a ridiculous thought as well. The same reason that I don't go to a barber to get my breakfast, because that barber's there to cut hair, and the cook is there to make breakfast. Well, maybe there's people that should be there to take out dams, and maybe that's what their calling is. You know, I don't think that it's anybody's calling from birth to be the one to dominate and control entire species. I think that's something that has to be taught. I think that's something that not only has to be taught, but it has to be indoctrinated. I think the resistance to that is probably one of the most natural effects that any living thing would feel. I mean, take that down all the way to single cells. You introduce into a single cell, other cells may they coexist peacefully or they don't. And if they don't, it creates cancer. When cells stop working together and one becomes domineering and controlling, it creates a cancer. And what does that cancer do? Does it remain and content with a little bit of cells that it's taken over? No, it goes like wildfires across fucking clear cuts. I mean, That's what happens. It seeps itself into the bloodstream to the point where you don't recognize what your nature is. You don't recognize that your nature is to be able to experience life on this planet, not to have it handed to you in plastic wrap. But we've had that stolen from us. We have to fight back. If not for ourselves, if not for our own moral code of life, at least to give our children and our grandchildren an opportunity to make the decisions of violence versus nonviolence. Because they're not going to have that decision. Children in Palestine don't have that decision. Their decision is, do I throw rocks today to remind myself what it is to be alive and not be a prisoner in my own land? That's a decision that has been thrust upon them. I'm sure of it. I'm sure of it that 98% of the people who have to fight in a liberation struggle would rather just be born free. I'm positive. You know, I'm positive because I would rather have been born free. I would rather be born nonviolent. I would rather be living in a society where it didn't murder the planet to live the way that I wanted to live. Unfortunately, I was told the way I had to live, and that way was destructive. And I'm doing everything I can, kicking and screaming, to get out of that way, and that's going to be a violent situation. That's just the way it is.
No, I totally see what you're saying, and I'm right along with you for most. Tony in Ohio, I know you're on the phone with us, and you still want to come in, and I'll invite you in just after I say this a little bit. Love your smiley face in the chat. It's completely predictable that violent resistance is going to happen. Okay, it's you know, and I'm not talking morally. It's an economic certainty. That violent resistance will take place. It will happen. And not only is it a guarantee and predictable, but you can also make plenty of logical arguments in support of whether or not it's warranted. Absolutely. I completely agree with you. However, I do think when we start talking in terms of not just resisting something, but fundamental core change to something, a fundamental shift in thinking to something does require different means, and it does require more challenging means, because when you're talking about having to persuade somebody of something,
persuade the prisoners that they're not in a prison?
No, they're absolutely in a prisoner. But when we're talking about ending the prisons and getting rid of the prisons,
so what do you have to convince the oppressor to stop oppressing?
You don't have to convince the oppressor. What you have to do is you have to convince your neighbor. You have to convince the regular people around you who, you know, for example, a very good friend of mine who is totally, you know, highly open-minded, highly liberal human being. Her impression of anarchism, of anarchists, is going into some fucking shitty house with a couple scary tattooed guys in a place that smells like dog piss. Now, I'm not saying all collectives smell like dog piss, okay? I will not make that claim right now. However, there are individuals in this world who are sympathetic to a lot of radical ideas, but ultimately are turned off by certain images. And those are the folks who need to we need to help as best we can to engender a paradigm shift.
Well,
and I'm sorry that change that I'm talking about. Now, you know, like, you know, fighting a prison guard, you know, for example, I read a story today, the Sudanese government just hung six guys who were involved in the deaths of 13 cops in 2005 during a mass eviction of about 10,000 people who were housed in this one particular area as a result of the civil war there. Those five were hanged in relation to the deaths of these 13 police. Now, when I read this story, I wasn't like, yeah, it's fucked up, they killed those cops. I didn't feel it, because that's what you have to expect. That is predictable. I have no emotional position against it because of the fact that it's a guarantee, it's 100% certainty that is going to happen. But the fact of the matter is that civil war is taking place, that these things are happening because the fundamental core of most of the participants of civilization is that the initiation of force is the way to accomplish to accomplish ends. And I understand resisting. I understand if someone comes at me and throws a punch, I'm going to resist, and I'm going to resist physically. I'm not arguing against that. What I'm arguing against is the notion that we can engender a fundamental socio-philosophic change in people through force. That's what I'm arguing is impossible to achieve.
I would say you're probably absolutely correct, but it's also absolutely fundamentally impossible to initiate a change in mass philosophical ideology living within the philosophical ideological prison system in which we live in.
Sure.
This system that we live in now has a monopoly upon the mind.
Totally.
They have a monopoly upon the heart, and they have a monopoly upon emotion.
Completely.
What they don't have a monopoly upon is wild action. They can't predict when somebody will step outside of their bounds, and they don't like it when they do. In fact, they put most of their money into the efforts to stop people from stepping outside of those bounds. Most of the money that you'll see goes into the efforts of co-opting movements. As soon as somebody has an idea that challenges the status quo, and that idea becomes something that masses pick up on, then that idea then becomes co-opted and bought out. Hence, I could go buy green fucking Clorox at Walgreens. What the fuck is green about Clorox or Walgreens? There's fucking nothing green about those things. Those things are fucking destructive. Yet, they slap a green symbol on, and all of a sudden, we're a part of a green environment, and we're a part of a green economy.
You can drink green Clorox. Right. That green.
It's bullshit. You know it, and I know it. So until the playing field is leveled, then there can be no freedom to collectively engenderize ourselves to a philosophy that we feel fits our community. It just can't happen, number one. Number two, I don't think that violence overthrowing the oppressor is going to change the hearts and minds of the people. Nobody thinks that. And that's not what we work on a daily basis. On a daily basis, I'm not out there, obviously, bricking cops in the face.
Right.
Because on a daily basis, I'm working on creating love. I'm raising my children. I'm playing music with my friends. I'm making food for strangers. I'm hanging out, and I'm having a great time enjoying this planet. That's what I'm here for. I'm here to have a great time and enjoy this planet at the cost as little as possible of everything around me, hopefully with a payment due at the end of my life with something much greater than I took out. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but we'll see. However, when a fucking line of riot cops step in front of me and my end goal of creating a system in our streets where we can have a voice, and those cops say you can't, and those cops have sticks and little rubber bullets that they're shooting at us, you're goddamn right I'm going to cheer every time I see one of them fall. You're goddamn right. Because they're the fucking enemy. They're the ones that are standing in the way of our freedom, so fuck them. Fuck them, fuck them, fuck them. Quit your job. Join our side. Become fucking jobless. Start fighting for what's fucking real. If you're not going to do that, then be willing to take a fucking punch from the side that is fighting for what's real.
So here's the first thing, is that wild action is absolutely predictable. They count on it. They count on people blowing up stuff, burning cars, so they can put you in a cage and they can put you on a fucking list.
Is that how one guy blew up the same fucking gas pipeline six times in Canada, putting an economic threat upon the company that was putting that gas line in so much so they had to declare bankruptcy and get bailed out by the fucking Canadian government? No.
Here's the point, though, is they got bailed out by the Canadian government. They didn't go away.
No.
Oh, they did go away. Okay, I changed my mind. Violence works.
But LNG pipelines did not go away.
another person stepped into their place.
Right.
And that's where your argument lies, that I agree with you. They take one down, 15 more will stand. Fuck, that's what the soldiers were saying in the Civil War.
I mean, there's a guy, his name's, you guys should check out, his name's Mike Golgoski. He's at the Center for the State Society. I want to get him on the show really bad. He was once told, if you don't like America, get out. So he said, okay. He filled out a form and renounced his citizenship and moved to Slovakia. And that's where he does all his writing and everything now. And he's a staunch voluntarist up to a point in which he says, you know, look, with these guys' protection gone, would I be sad to see – and this is a guy who he's in the market anarchy field. You know, this guy's into economics and stuff. But his own words were, would I be sad to see CEOs' heads on pikes? No. You know, he's like, despite the fact that
– I think it's a waste of a good pike.
You know, and here's the thing is that – you know, full restitution can't come as long as they've got thugs guarding them. You know, those banks in Argentina were protected by state cops during the economic collapse. And you know, I believe that those individuals who take part in the rape of the planet and the rape of their fellow species and animals have restitution coming and deserve it, arguably.
What does restitution look like, though? Does that look like – is restitution a shift in the philosophical paradigm of the culture? No. Restitution is a way to buy people out. Reformation is a way to buy people out and maintain your power.
That's absolutely wrong. Restitution is being held fully responsible for your actions.
But maintaining the same system in which you live currently.
Not necessarily, because who's resuscitified?
Well,
that's a word.
In what way can they repay restitution? In what way could they bring back wild coho? In what way could they bring back old growth forests? In what way could they bring back generations who have been detached from the land base? In what way can they pay restitution for that?
Well,
by paying fines?
And, you know,
disbanding their
company? We've talked about this before. I mean, maybe that restitution, maybe the way they'll pay for that, maybe it will be with their lives. I mean, I can't make that judgment because I'm not a judge, and I'm not entirely comfortable with trying to be judge and jury, so I won't go there.
They're full of petrochemicals, they wouldn't even be good in compost.
Exactly. And they probably survived the burying anyway, like zombies and Jesus. But, you know, fundamentally, to get to that point where these individuals can actually be held fully responsible for their actions, you know, I don't think we're going to, you know, obviously violence against the state, it can't succeed. You have to come up with invisible things that they actually can't see and that they can't track. That's why, you know, I'm really into counter economics from that perspective, because it's a way for people to start using their day-to-day activities to starve the system and bring it down rapidly. I mean, the 9/11 attacks were an attack not on a building, but they were an economic attack, and they were resoundingly successful. Resoundingly successful.
How so?
Well, I mean, for the only time in my life that I've ever seen the Talking Heads beg us to do anything was in the 3 days after 9/11, in which they were begging us to go out and shop. And it's not about consumerism. That's because the system is so fragile. It's built on such a fragile, fragile economic system that in those few days where everybody was too scared to shop, the economy would have collapsed. If that had continued for another couple of weeks to the dramatic degree that it was in those few days after 9/11, this entire economy would have collapsed very, very quickly. Very, very quickly. Because the one thing that they can't force you to do, the one thing that they can't predict, is the counter-economy. They can't predict whether or not people are going to use cash today. They can't force you to go to the store. They can only beg you to do it. It's the only thing that they can't predict.
Okay, I have to disagree. Every natural waterway in our communities is polluted. There are no fish. Hunting, as a means to stay alive, is all but gone in this country for most people. Those are three pretty basic things that we need. We need clean water, and we need food, both all kinds of food. We need vegetation, and we need to be able to sustain ourselves. That's a forceful way to force us to shop, force us to play a part in their system, is to control the means of water and food. Those are controlled. So starving out the system while starving yourself doesn't take away the system. All it does is bring down a repressive force of the state much harder. And it also doesn't delete the oppressive forces that exist. Boycotts are great because boycotts have an end mean. And the means to that end are, I'm not going to give you money to do what you do, so So I'm boycotting you in the hopes that you will stop. And if you stop doing what you do, I'll support you again. It's such bullshit. Okay, so there's, in Israel right now, there's a lot of companies that are profiting from the destruction of the occupied territories. We're talking about like Cat, for instance, Caterpillar. It's one of the biggest companies that support the destruction of Palestinian homes by bulldozers and various bulldozing type equipment. I don't know big machines. I don't know the names of them. My 4-year-old son is really into big machines. He can tell me the name of every truck. I don't know what they're called. I know Caterpillar makes them. I know they make a shit ton of money off of selling them to the Israeli government to use them to destroy Palestinian communities. So there's a call for a boycott on companies that invest. They're asking for divestment. Divest from Israel. Divest from this. Divest from that. What are we really asking for? Are we telling that there's a reward if you listen to our form of punishment of not shopping with you? There's some reward at the end of this line. What I'm saying is the only reward that could exist is if these companies just stop existing and if these ideas go away because they don't have the means to destroy. Now, I could take a suicidal maniac, a homicidal maniac, and a peace-loving monk and put them in 3 separate cages, and I don't really have to worry about any of them doing their thing. Right, I could separate them out, and they're fine. I could take the CEO of Monsanto, and I could take away his toys, and he's just a dude who has really douchebaggy ideas. That's what I'm saying. We don't have to kill these guys. We just have to take away their ability to kill us. Is that such a big deal? Is that going to require violence? Absolutely. Because they're going to pay people to stand in front of it and protect it, and that sucks. So if what you're talking about is people stop getting paid to be cops, stop being cops? Sure, quit your job. All the cops across the earth. Boom. Okay, awesome. That's step one. Step two, stop being soldiers. Awesome. Those two things gone, what chances do these companies have to survive? Not a whole lot. If people stop being cops, period, then there's a good chance we'll have a level playing field. That's not likely to happen.
From, again, and you guys just have to get used to this with me because I'm really into economics, so I often make all my arguments from an economic point of view. I apologize in advance. Don't tread on me. With the snake. People react in accordance with incentives and disincentives. People will do shit if you pay them. Now, in our economic system, we have what is called fiat money. Okay, fiat money means that you have one central organization that controls this particular mode of trade. When you have something like fiat money, you create an incentive for greedy hoarding behavior. So what we have to do is we have to make their systems obsolete. Obviously, we can't go into a head-on, face-to-face battle in the streets with these cats because we'll die. But what we can do is we can make their systems obsolete. And this is in through little things every day, not through 2 or 3 big actions, but millions of small actions every day. For instance, giving your friend a haircut and not charging them anything. It doesn't seem like anything, but that's a counter-economic activity. That is your energy, the fruits of your labor that you have kept out of the system. And let me just say that
free haircuts don't stop genocide.
What did Hitler not stop? Or killing Hitler didn't stop war or some ridiculous shit like that. But it's through,
what did Hitler not stop?
it's through millions of little actions that we empower ourselves to make these systems obsolete. And one of the best ways to do that is to do stuff for free. If you want to fight money and you want to fight against these systems of value and trade that engender greed and hoarding, then offer stuff for free. This is one of the most important roles that I think anarchists can serve. And that unfortunately, I think sometimes we're our own worst enemies. Is building these type of organizations. Things like Doctors Without Borders is a great organization that's doing a lot around the world, particularly with what's going on in Haiti. And these are doctors, these are medical practitioners who are acting counter-economically and offering services for free.
What services are they offering?
Medical shit. I don't really read any of
that. Medicine, right? Medicine. Pharmaceuticals developed in the Western civilization, Western first world, that people have become dependent upon, and now they're introducing them into indigenous cultures who have never used these medicines before, but now they're going to become diabetic because Coca-Cola just shipped 1,000 gallons of Coke to Haiti.
I'm not offering some flawless, impenetrable philosophic framework, because obviously there's lots of problems with that shit. What I'm talking about is this specific psychological disposition where offering services offering yourself, offering the fruits of your work, just simply working with other people to help engender a better societal framework. Doing that and making that part of our day-to-day activity in every little moment and every little facet of our lives, whenever and wherever we can, in my opinion, can dramatically, will dramatically, not destroy in this like kind of very poetic, up in flames, V for Vendetta type of thing, but it will make the current systems obsolete to where those guys can't pay their people anymore because their money's been made obsolete. It's no good anymore. Where the state can't pay their employees, they can't pay their armies, they can't provide them for them because their systems have been made obsolete simply by the million. And this is, and I'm not talking about something that doesn't happen. I'm not talking about an ideal. This is stuff that people, you know, a big part of the reason the Soviet government was brought down was through the counter economy. It was because people stopped participating.
The counter economy was capitalism.
Well, the counter economy was simply people was people opting out of the system and working with each other. And you know, you don't need capitalism for a counter economy. A counter economy is doing stuff for free.
But in the case
mutual
you just
aid
about,
is the counter economy.
The case you just talked about was capitalism coming into the Soviet Union and disrupting their socialist government's power source over the
what region. That means is people started to trade and interact with each other completely outside of government. I'm talking about individual citizens. I'm not talking about
that's not
I'm not talking about businessmen.
The Soviet Union.
I didn't say that's what brought it down. I said that's what that's a big part of what brought it down, because there are estimated hundreds of billions of dollars kept from the American tax system simply because people behave counter-economically.
Let me ask you something. Do you think that these greedy bastards are doing this for the money?
Like any greedy bastard?
Like the greediest of the greedy bastards. The fucking Donald Rumsfeld. Is he doing what he's doing for the money? Is Bernanke doing what he's doing for the money?
Well, what they're doing is they're doing it for the monopoly of power. They're doing it for monopolies of resources. What they're doing is they're reacting naturally to incentives that are built within the institutions of civilization, which encourage greed, which encourage violence, which encourage all of these things that we both and you know most anarchists all dislike.
Right.
They're all reacting quite naturally and very predictably to what is built into the system. An anarchist, the opportunity there is to not react to those incentives, to reject those incentives and act counter to them.
Okay, problem with that is they do control the resources. And any incentive that you could take away from them monetarily, one of the systems of control they have, which is a very minor system of control at this point. Obviously, if you wanted to control the world with money, you wouldn't leave 80% of its population without that tool of control. Taking it away doesn't necessarily control them either. Not having money doesn't make you under the control of the state any more than having $1 million puts you in control of the state. The money is a farcity. It's fake. Coming up with alternative economics, yeah, that's awesome because that's what we have to do to stay alive. That's a necessary tool of living. People do these things all the time. We trade food with each other all the time. And it's not a philosophical idea. It's just what we do because that's what we need. We need to trade services with each other because we're broke. That's not bringing down these monsters because money is not what that fucking Bernanke makes the money. In his basement. Dude has the machine that makes the money. I don't think he's doing this with the interest of making more money.
Prints it on his Apple computer.
There is another premise underlying that which tells these people that they have some divine right to control this world because they have been gifted with it. And they often use this, because most of them are Christians, they use this like, well, God has given me so many gifts. And it's because of God that I'm a millionaire. No, televangelist, dickface. It's because you lie to little old ladies that you're a millionaire. That's why you're a fucking millionaire, because you're a pig. You're a pig and a poor salesman. That's why you're a millionaire. And it's never going to change if we change the money system. That's not going to take away the power these fuckers have, because these fuckers control us with machinery. They control us. Like that post that you gave me about the lady who was saying, you know, she saw a guy in the hospital who was hooked up to life support, and she put out a living will that told her kids, like, if you ever see me be dependent upon a machine and a bottle to stay alive, I want you to unplug it and just kill me so the kids unplugged the computer and threw out all of her wine. You know, yeah, that's funny, but it doesn't change the fact that there are these machines in play that do control us, and they are going to have to be stopped. And what do they use as a shield in front of these machines? Do they beg and plead? And do they knock door to door to say, excuse me, hi, I'm with the gas company, and we're going to put in a new LNG pipeline that's looking like it's going to destroy 700 acres through your Mount Hood National Forest. It's going to cross 60 of your streams and pollute your water. Could you sign on to that, please? Absolutely not. They fucking do what they want because they can.
And what do they do to stop it? They hire fucking thugs to scare the shit out of people. That's exactly what they do. And if you fight against it, they put you in jail or they kill you. That's what they've done, and that's what they'll do again. So how do we stop them? Do we stop them by changing our economic system? By trading fucking green peppers for sweet corn out of our gardens? By getting free haircuts?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You
Why, the question is, why do you think most people are obeying this? Is that for either one of us or for one of us?
Yeah, I think you're both going to take different answers.
Okay, so the question is, why are we – and Tony from Ohio, Tony in Ohio, you're on the line and your mic's been open. Just,
yeah,
jump,
just
in
jump in
and interrupt
whatever you want, dude.
All right,
but the question from the audience is, why do you think people are obeying the system?
So, Tony, do you want to answer that?
I think for the most part, just because they don't realize the system's an illusion, that they really think that somebody's looking over their shoulder all the time. They don't realize that it's kind of a ridiculous idea that you can go through your everyday life pretty much and nobody's really watching you. Like the crimes that have the hardest penalties are the ones that are hardest to enforce. The easiest ones to enforce have the least penalty. If you're talking about assault on somebody or something, that happens kind of infrequently. People don't go around beating each other up as a general rule, and it has kind of a low penalty because it's easy to enforce. People voluntarily don't want to beat each other up. You talk about something that they want to ban, like drugs, they give very stiff penalties like life sentences because it's almost impossible to enforce. So really, people don't follow it to a large degree. It's just an illusion that they follow it. They slightly shrink a market and turn it over to criminals turn it over so that there's no way for children to be kept away from things on the premise that it makes us safe from ourselves, I guess. And I think it's largely an illusion.
Okay, so I think what you're saying is people obey the system because they don't necessarily realize the system's there. Is that summing it up, what you're saying?
They've grown up in it, so they don't realize that they don't have to. That it's like,
okay. Harriet Tubman once said she was a runaway slave who helped free a bunch of other slaves, a few hundred actually, and using various methods. She was pioneer of the Underground Railroad, and she said once that I could have freed so many more if they'd only known that they were slaves.
There you go.
And that's a very interesting Keanu Reeves Matrix kind of idea of freeing yourself if only you knew that you weren't free. Another interesting Harriet Tubman fact is what Harriet Tubman took with her on these runs to free these slaves in the Underground Railroad. She took a few things. She took a gun, she took a couple bullets, and she took some morphine. The morphine was for if there was an injury or if somebody was so nervous and scared they were going to be attacked that she would give them a shot of morphine to calm them down. And if the morphine didn't work and somebody was being loud and scared and threatening the safety of everybody in that trip, she used the gun. That's a simple fact. She brought that gun because she knew that at times, in a culture of insanity, you will use insane measures. In a culture of dominance, control, and fear, that you're going to be scared sometimes. You're going to dominate sometimes, and you're going to be dominated at other times. That's just the culture that we live in. Now, did she escape that culture by escaping slavery? Not necessarily, but it was a step. It was a small step, but it was a vital step for those who were freed. So will taking out the Grand Coulee Dam solve our problems and end civilization? Fuck no. Will it end the occupation of Palestine? Fuck no. Will it save rainforests in South America? You're goddamn insane if you think it's going to do that. But will it bring back some salmon runs into the Columbia Snake River chain? Probably. Will they try to rebuild it? Yeah, of course they will. But guess what? The interesting thing about anything that's built is it can be unbuilt. And if it's unbuilt once, it can be unbuilt again. And again and again and again.
Yeah, but you know, the key to what you're saying is again and again and again. This is cyclical. This happens. Oh, snap. CIA's cracking out. We just carried this show. Can we get a shout out? We carried this show for 2 hours.
I just want to give it up to everybody who sat in Muddy Waters listening to us talk our bullshit for the last 2 hours. You guys are troopers. If I had money, I'd buy you all a beer.
They're all
but
that,
I don't have any money and no money at all.
Because the cafe stayed open 2 extra hours. It's cold outside.
So, okay, so we do have 1 minute left. Tony in Ohio, thanks for calling in, brother. And I look forward to chatting up with you more. I miss talking with you, chatting with you in the chat rooms and stuff. Hit me up on Facebook. Are we Facebook friends? FB, what's up, dog?
I'm on a satellite connection, so I don't really do the Facebooks and stuff because they got so many pictures for my my signal to download, and I have limited bandwidth.
Oh, that's right. You're Amish. I forgot.
I do live around a bunch of Amish. I do.
Awesome. Well, if you live in Ohio, you have to support the Amish because they make whoopie pies, and they're awesome. Basically, you could form an economy on whoopie pies. If you've ever had them, they're amazing.
Form a counter economy using whoopie pies.
Absolutely.
So next week we don't have a guest signed up yet for next week.
We may get
a guest.
How does this work tonight? I realize that we just talked for 2 hours. Usually we do this from our home. We talk about this much. Was this boring as shit to all of you guys? Honestly, give us an honest opinion. Maybe we'll have musical guests more often. How about that? Oh, okay. Well,
nice.
Cool.
Nice. Good enough.
Cool.
Good enough.
Well, the show is on but not streaming, so we're still recording.
Well, thanks so much, everybody, for coming and sticking around and listening to us. And we're here every Sunday, 6 o'clock, Bottom Up Radio Network. Go to bottomupradicalnetwork.ning.com. Join us in the social networking. Let's keep this conversation going through the week. Talk about ideas. In the meantime, do something illegal this week.
Yeah, let's make it a point that each of us does something, at least one thing that's illegal. It doesn't have to be harmful or violent.
Yeah, steal
or,
a book.
You know, like, just something slightly illegal to remind yourself that you're free.
Take a shit somewhere you're not supposed to. There's plenty of places.
But not in somebody's yard, because somebody took a shit in my yard once, and it was really annoying. And if it annoyed me, it's going to annoy everybody else.
Yeah.
Unless you have the name and address of a CEO or a politician and the sound you absolutely hate. Yeah. And by the way, they do have names and addresses.
They do.
All of them. And just you go on, look up tax records, I guarantee you that there's only one Dick Cheney that owns 7 houses worth $8 million apiece. You'll get his address pretty quick on
there's
tax records.
There's plenty of room in his mailbox
completely
for
legal.
One turd.
Completely legal to shit on Dick Cheney's yard.
All right.
All right, everybody.
Good night, everyone. Thanks so much for coming. Let's give one more shout, everyone, and have a good night. Right, then. Off we go.